you'll see that the cost of 60 credit hours at Eastern Michigan University is $10,000 higher than the cost of 60 credit hours at Henry Ford Community College. It's $12,000 higher at Oakland University and $17,000 higher at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Remember, we offer a four-year tuition freeze guarantee, which assures you that today's tuition rates will be frozen for students who graduate from HFCC within 4 years. Henry Ford Community College is located near the corners of Ford and Evergreen Roads. Visit hfcc.edu for more details. The choice is clear. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, 1 second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
WHFR Dearborn.
Welcome to Dearborn Heights News and Views, a talk show program as part of the WHFR Forum Series, presented on Tuesdays from 1 to 2 p.m., on the fifth Tuesday of any month, by Ned Epigian, your host. The Forum talk show programs are presented on WHFR 89.3, the station making waves from the Henry Ford Community College campus in Dearborn Music. And now to our host, Ned Epigian, and today's program of Dearborn Heights News and Views.
Alex, thank you very much. You did a wonderful job. Anyway, today's guest on our program is none other than the fire chief of the city of Dearborn Heights. We're going to get acquainted with him on a personal basis. We're going to find out, hopefully, a lot about the fire, not so much what the fire chief does, but something about, a lot about the Dearborn Heights Fire Department, and what firemen do in general, and we're going to take a great deal of today's program talking about that, but at first, I'm going to try to acquaint you with our fire chief, and his name is, if you don't know, Andrew G. Gurka, and a little profile about him. He is a professionally trained and educated fire service administrator with 25 years of experience in fire suppression prevention and EMS. To look at him, you wouldn't believe he'd be that old. He looks like my son. His education is a Master of Science in Administration from Madonna University, a Bachelor of Science in Occupational Safety, also at Madonna University. His career history is fire chief since October 05 to the present, in the city of Dearborn Heights, of course. And he manages all aspects of the department, in order to provide efficient and effective fire prevention, fire suppression, and EMS? All these are interesting questions we're going to ask him, because the public needs to know how these things work. He was a fire marshal from 02 to 05, and we're going to find out what fire marshals do. He's administered fire education programs, responsible fire department records, directed fire hydrant maintenance, and we're going to talk about all these things, and he's going to give us a little insight. He's a fire inspector from 98. He's a firefighter from 85 to 98. His training is in many areas, customer service, fire investigations, and all these things we're going to kind of ask him about. And he's a member of several international associations of fire chiefs in southeastern Michigan, western Wayne County, Metro Detroit. Chief Gurka, welcome to this program, and I hope you enjoy this informative series.
Well, thank you very much, Ned. I really appreciate you having me here on the show. And we can talk all things fire today.
All things fire. Well, first of all, the format that you've provided me is extremely interesting as to what these people do. But you want to tell us something about yourself personally? I'd appreciate it. Something about yourself.
Well, you know, some people will ask me, well, when did you become interested in the fire service? And I think, like a lot of, you know, young boys, when I was 5 years old, you know, our school went to the fire station. It was actually in Garden City. And we toured the station, and that was kind of my first taste of a firehouse and looking at the shiny red trucks, and kind of put something in the back of my mind, I think, all these years that, you know, these were a good bunch of guys and gals, and they were out there to help the public. And so, you know, later in life, I kind of picked up and pursued toward the fire service.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting, because almost every little boy, when they're young, they say, I want to be a fireman or a policeman. I can't say I had that attitude myself, but it's a common little boy thing in America. So that's the background. What did you actually do? The interesting thing is, how do you become a firefighter? How did you become one? What's the critical professional path? I want to be a fireman. What do you do?
Well, that's a real good question, because if you want to become a suburban firefighter, where you're also going to be required to do EMS runs, emergency medical runs, you may need a little more training than, let's say, some of the big city fire departments. For example, Detroit, they separate their EMS service and their fire service. Mm. So to become a firefighter in Detroit, you would not necessarily need to have as much emergency medical training as you would in some of the suburbs.
You need to kill two birds with one stone.
Yes, exactly. And our firefighters are cross-trained as paramedics in Dearborn Heights and in other communities. And so what one has to do is not only achieve some minimum requirements for firefighter, but you also need to obtain your state of Michigan paramedic license, which requires a little more training.
So at first you have to become a fireman first. How do you do that?
Well,
do you have to go to a training somewhere? Does the state of Michigan have some control over that, or do all the cities manage that themselves?
Well, I think every community can be a little bit different as far as what they require, but a lot of communities will ask that the candidate have a firefighter 1 and 2 training, which is courses and classes that you could obtain at some of the community colleges.
Oh, so there are community college programs. I assume here at Henry Ford Community College, we have such a program?
You have some of the programs here. There's other local colleges and universities that have programs also.
How long are they? 6 months, 16 months, 2 years?
Well, you could probably achieve some of those basic courses that you need within about 1 to 2 years. Dearborn Heights, for example, the city of Dearborn Heights requires that our candidates at least have 60 college credits. So we like to have that because that shows us that somebody is willing to, you know, commit themselves to a goal, classwork, you know, achieve it.
In that program or in some general?
It could be generalized. However, you could also obtain some of your firefighter training and get college credit for it, and that would be the most efficient way to do it.
Okay, so an individual goes through one of the community college, meets the requirements of the 60 credit hours, and then has to make application someplace?
Yes.
Or has to do something else with the state?
Well, what we're requiring in Dearborn Heights also, besides the 60 college credits, is we're looking for that state of licensure in paramedic, state of Michigan licensure. So you would also have to
take training. That's before you become a fireman, not after.
No, that's before. You're correct. And years ago, it's possible that there was many departments that trained individuals after they were hired on in their EMS. But now the tables have turned, and the onus has been put on the individual to have this training before they are hired.
Where do you get that at?
Well, once again, there are community colleges, universities, and there are some private companies out there that teach basic EMT or advanced EMT, which is a paramedic program. That program will take you just under a year if you do an accelerated version of it, because there are some clinicals involved. I mean, you have to go to a hospital and you have to spend time in the emergency room practicing some of these hands-on skills that you are trained in that course.
You have to do that at any hospital or teaching hospital?
Well, there's usually participating hospitals with whatever program you're with. And, for example, when I did some training many years ago for EMT, I did my training at Detroit Receiving Hospital.
Seems like a good place.
And it was a good place. There was a lot of action that I was exposed to early on. In fact, my first day there, we had a gunshot wound. We had an individual who was involved in a house fire and he had a lot of smoke inhalation. And we had some homeless individuals that had overdosed. So you get a lot of good training at some of these area hospitals.
So 60 credit hours is that 2 years or one? Closer to two. I'm trying to think. 15 credit hours a semester. And our wonderful co-host has joined us today, Jay Koronick, the station advisor. Anyway, he's joined us in a big way. Jay, we have just our program closing already put on there. Our dear friend Alex Abbas right there.
Well, I just wanted to say I was had to get here driving through Dearborn Heights and you know, I had to be careful of that speed trap on Ford Road. Oh. Just joking. but we're going to talk about that in the second half of the show, Ned. I've got a couple stories here about Dearborn Heights, and we'd like to see what's going on.
Let's see. Now,
so, by the way, welcome, Chief Gurka. We've talked before here and on the WHFR Journal. So welcome to the special Dearborn Heights show.
Yeah, thank you, Jay. It's a real pleasure to be back here. I really enjoyed being on your show before with the Goodfellows. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Right, I remember that. Okay, so we're talking about 2 years, 3 years if that other EMT training is for about a year. Now, a person that goes through that is not assured anything. He has to make after that, he can make applications at various suburban
Well, almost, Ned, because, there's also something called the Conference of Western Wayne Testing Certificates that are required. Mm. And what those involve is there's a written test and there's a physical agility test. And it really tries to assure that the candidates have a basic level of physical fitness and that they seem to possess, you know, the ability to, you know, to learn, to retain information, And there, and those tests, the written test is really looking for somebody that would be kind of a quick learner, somebody that retains information and is going to fit in real well with the fire department.
So the Western Wayne, how this certification or this schooling, how long does that take?
Well, this Conference of Western Wayne Testing is something that the candidate would apply to take, and he would take these tests, and if he achieved minimum passing scores, he would have these successful certificates that he could bring to the community that is hiring, and they would acknowledge those.
How long does that take?
Well, the testing really doesn't take that long. It's just a matter of getting it scheduled and doing a little training for it, because if you're not familiar with, let's say, the physical agility test, you may want to train a little bit ahead of time to make sure you can perform those tasks that are required. And some communities have their own agility.
This is where you learn it? This is where you're tested?
Well, these Conference of Western Wayne tests are conducted at community colleges, and they, once you pass them there, you bring the certificate with you to your community that you're applying for.
So this is in addition to the 60 hours?
Yes, that's correct. Also, I may want to add that we look at your driving record also. We're looking for somebody that has a pretty clean driving record. I'm not saying that, you know, if someone got a ticket once in their life for something minor, that that we understand things happen in life. However, I mean, we're really looking at that record and making sure this individual hasn't been involved in a lot of accidents, that they haven't had drunk driving convictions, that there aren't some other things going on there with their driving record.
Yeah, that brings me to another thing. Does everybody qualify to drive the vehicles, all the trucks?
Well, that's a good question, in that we have qualified drivers that drive the rescue squad, which is our ambulance, and everybody is qualified to drive that. Then we have a little higher level of driver's training, and that's for our fire engines, our fire trucks. And you do have to get some additional training. You have to pass some in-house testing and to be able to be qualified to drive the fire truck.
Those are the two you have at both your stations.
Yeah,
they're major vehicles.
Yeah, that's correct. We also run some utility vehicles, which are really F-250 pickup trucks that we use to do a lot of errands and pick up equipment from the hospital and do grocery shopping, things like that.
That doesn't require any training.
Just your valid driver's license is good enough for that.
So this ordeal takes about 3 years?
Well, you can get it done sooner if, let's say, concurrently while you were getting your 60 college credits, you were also getting paramedic credits, and you were getting some firefighter 1 and 2 training in there.
So you could be doing that thing at receiving hospital at the same time? Is that the idea?
Well, you could.
That you went through.
You might be able to work in your clinicals also in that time period. I would say that your average person might take a little bit longer than that to get the training, maybe 2.5
So you call that
years.
Clinicals, that on-the-job training?
Yeah, those clinicals are what you're going to need to get your paramedic license in the state.
Okay,
of Michigan.
Once a person achieves that, how many people are in your fire department? I have no idea.
Well, you know, including myself, we have 53 full-time firefighting personnel.
That's about two-thirds the size of the police department. It's about 75 or so, or 90. What is it?
Well, it's you know, we're...
So there's less firemen than there is policemen.
Yes, that's correct. There's less firemen than policemen.
And until you told me there was 53, I thought it was about the same.
Yeah, no, there's definitely more on the police force. I know a lot of times, you know, the police won't advertise exact numbers, you know, how many cars are on the road at any given time, number
of
personnel.
Not so much that, but they have this requirement of number of police officers that's required based on population, isn't it?
Well, I know, the city of Dearborn may have some special requirements related to that, whereas Dearborn Heights would not be under
that. Okay.
Yeah, if I can intersperse here. Yes, the city of Dearborn, in a couple of referendums to the public, they did pass minimum staffing requirements for both police and fire. And I think the fire department was the last one passed. I think they had police department before. City administrators don't like that. They feel that in budget crunch times, they need flexibility. But apparently the public in Dearborn feels, anyway, by those referendums, that they wanted consistent staffing based on population.
So what did they decide in Dearborn?
They did pass it.
And do you remember what the number is?
No, I don't, but it's some sort of nationally known percentage. But obviously, Chief Gurka, you know the number of fires you have a year. Do you feel that at this point you're understaffed? You wouldn't want to say that, but I mean...
He is.
Well, no, I think we're adequately staffed. Yeah. We are two down at this time, but we can, you know, very readily absorb that as things potentially improve.
Why do you have two down? You mean two people retired and or something?
Yes, that's correct. Two people have retired, and we haven't filled those vacancies.
Now, that's when you go to your list of applicants that meet all these requirements?
Yes, that's when you can go to the
list.
When
and if you decide to fill, that's up to your discretion.
Well, it's up to discussions between myself and the mayor. The mayor is really the ultimate hiring and firing authority in our community.
Really?
Since I brought this up, again, this is Jay Koronick, folks. And remember, the opinions expressed in the show are not necessarily those of anyone here, but we hope it challenges your thoughts on this. I assume, though, that you might have some firefighters on call who are not full-time, or is everyone full-time there that in an emergency you could call in additional help? Of course, I assume you could also call in additional help from other nearby city fire departments, too. You must have relationships like that. So we don't want to imply anything here because Dearborn has a secure number that's magic, that you have a number of staffing options, too, I assume, in a particularly a crisis situation.
Yeah, that's correct. We did disband our volunteer fire force several years ago, so we don't have that group to go to. We do have a mutual aid pack with 22 other communities that we could utilize in the event of a large-scale incident.
What happens when that happens? Do you have to pay them?
Well, how the agreement exists now is that really the first operational period, we really don't do any billing for that. It's generally agreed upon that we come in and assist. If we had a longer-term event, then we could look at... something like that.
Generally, it's for gratis then, yes, Jay?
Well, I just also wanted to say, just to be, positive about this, too, and not to scare any people in Dearborn Heights or give them the wrong impression, but these nearby communities, they're right next door. I mean, we're all in one big metro area, so the nearest fire stations are probably in these other communities no more than 10 minutes away at most.
They're interlocked. The communities are so interlocked like a puzzle that a Dearborn station might even be close.
An out-of-control fire at the border of Dearborn Heights is obviously a concern to the Dearborn or whichever side that's on. What are the other... contingent communities? Would it be Garden City on West View?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, we have Garden City, we have Livonia, we have Detroit, we have Dearborn, we have Taylor and Allen Park, Inkster. So we have these other communities that we can rely on, but we can go out from there if needed, beyond. I think I mentioned the 22 other communities. We go as far out as right now, like Van Buren Township, that out that way will go as far as that.
You only have two fire stations. There's only so much help you could give, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Depends how far you can go. Van Buren Township is a little striking distance from you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And before we need to go out there, we'd have some closer communities assisting us. But you know, we're able to handle our day-to-day incidents pretty well with the two stations. We do use mutual aid a lot for medical calls because it's not really uncommon to get two medical calls at once.
So then somebody
else
will come.
Ah,
that's interesting, Jay, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, that's... you know, there's a myth about fire. You know, the New York incident, they were so much father and son, in Uncle and the same station, which seemed to me, well, you couldn't be a fireman unless your father was, and at station 119 or something. Mm-hmm. So how does that work here?
Well, you know, I really think...
Have that? Or well, is that an old-timers deal thing?
I think it's an old-timers thing in that, you know, with civil service now and with a testing procedure and a testing process in place, you're not going to see as much of that. Now, what I think you can see, though, is somebody who's in the fire service now, if they're mentoring and giving little tips and hints to somebody that's going through the process, you know, I think that can be real helpful. And I think that's really what's going on today more than some kind of... you know, nepotism or getting someone in because they're a relative.
Okay, that process we talked about earlier is requiring, should solve that problem. Now, one of the things, what does a fire marshal do? Here in your own resume, you have a listing of things. I know as an architect, the architect's a little upset with fire marshals. Every once in a while, they say, oh, the guy's just a fireman. What's he over here telling me what to do?
Well, and I can understand.
What do fire marshals do?
I can understand a little frustration. You know, architects, and Ned, you're an architect, highly trained in design and in the code and what you really need to build this structure and put it all down in plan form. And the fire marshal is really there to look at new construction plans. That's one of his duties, and make sure that it conforms with the code that we've adopted in our community that would cover a lot of, you know, life safety and fire safety aspects of the building.
What has the city of Dearborn Heights adopted the building code of 2006 or is it 2003?
Well, we're under the International Fire Code is what our what we administer as far mm-hmm. as the fire marshal would.
Because I know the 2009 hasn't been out yet, but cities take years to adopt them. The city might have six, the other one might have three.
That's true, and it's not unusual to be, you know, a few years behind on adopting a code because you want to see what kind of changes are in there, and you want to see if there's anything else you may want to add or change when you...
Well, they change all the time. If you ask me, I couldn't... One time I was talking to a friend of mine. We were talking... This had to do with risers in a stair. And I said, gee, most stairs are 7 1/4, aren't they? And he said, nah, not since that last code. Now you can't have a riser higher than 7. So no matter what you're doing, you better look at that to see it's
well you're what it is. Absolutely right, because, you know, you brought up, you know, like risers and tread depths on stairs. You know, that could be an aspect, a fire safety aspect, if these stairs are built incorrectly and it's a means of mm-hmm. egress. You need to get out of the building and you trip and stumble and fall and you can't escape in time. Certainly, yeah, you want those stairs built to code, and what the code specifies, yes, may change over time.
Yeah. What does a fire inspector do?
Well, the fire inspector, they're out in the field, they're out on the ground, they're out there going in commercial businesses, inspecting them, you know, to make sure they're safe for the public. And I think, you know, the public can take for granted that they can go into a movie theater or a shopping center or a small business and feel safe and feel if something happened in that business that they would have adequate time to escape, that the life safety systems would be functioning. You know, things like exit signs, emergency lighting, fire extinguishers.
Do you have any upcoming fire department events that the public would like to know about?
Well, we just had our chili cook-off, which was a big fundraiser.
Oh, no, I missed that. Oh, I love chili. Oh, darn.
Yeah, this was this last Saturday, and it was a success. I don't have the exact numbers for you, but...
Got the winning recipe with you? no? Is that on our website somewhere?
I didn't even know, man.
I don't know if it's up on the website yet, but we'll have to watch for that. I know.
It was obviously a fundraiser as one of many activities in that regard, but community outreach too, I bet.
Yeah, absolutely, and the funds there go to the Great Lakes Burn Camp to send send kids to camp who have had burn injuries and give them an opportunity to be with other kids that may have experienced some similar things and you know, highly trained counselors that can help deal with their situation.
For our listeners and residents, the fire safety ideas, could you share a couple of the most important ones?
Especially maybe in this season, in the summer, we have to watch out for, I assume, backyard barbecuing and grills and that, but there are other things that we're,
we
don't think about.
Christmas lights.
Well, that's Christmas, but right now...
Well, let's talk about a couple of these things. You know, you mentioned the barbecue grills, and you know what? Over the years, you would be surprised how many people will discard coals and hot items that they've used barbecuing, you know, and mix them with combustibles, and only to have a fire kind of develop a little bit later. You know, it'll smolder and it'll develop and turn into a nasty fire. So, you know, as we advise, you know, if you're going to discard those materials, you know, you got to put them in a covered metal can, you know, leave them outside your garage, outside of the house, you know, let them sit there. Same with...
Like ashes, hot ashes?
Yeah.
Where do they normally toss them? I can't believe that. I mean, usually I just thought people will let them simmer away in their grill for a day or two.
But stay there. Right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think most people do, but some people, they'll have a party, they'll be cleaning up, they may want to get some... They had some burned food or some residue tin foil and maybe some coals, and they just kind of ball it up, throw it in the trash.
Oh, no.
And it comes back to haunt
them. In the house, there must be a lot of things. Do we all need a fire extinguisher in the house?
Well, I think so, absolutely. I think that, you know, you have that one extinguisher, which the size that's good for your average home would be a 2A 10BC, and you mount it somewhere where you could get at it and then get out.
Where do you get it?
You need to.
2A 10BC.
Right. That would be the size of
the extinguisher. Is this a foam thing?
Well, it's an all-purpose extinguisher, and it uses dry.
What size is that? I know there's some that are not much larger than your hand size, like 6 inches long or something. Yeah. Is this the standard size? Would have more capacity than that, or is that about right?
This size, you know, you may have heard called a 10-pounder. That size is really adequate for your
most
for your
fires
household.
Anyway.
Well, you have how about if you have a stove fire with oil? Does it take care of that too? You don't want to put water in it.
No, this one actually
flowers
will. This one will, but you have to be careful. You know, when you disperse this extinguisher, you don't want to put the nozzle right up to the burning grease and then
spread
it all around.
Mm, okay,
you really need to to get back. But we always say, you know, keep that pan lid handy. You know, shut off the power to the stove. Try to do some things. You know, shut the burner off. Try to do some things to
mitigate. How about have flour nearby to throw it on? I've heard of that.
Well, but you know, flour, believe it or not, is a big problem because you could actually get a little dust explosion with flour, and flour burns. Mm. So you have to remember, you know, baking soda would be the thing to use, but flour is a no-no.
So keep some baking soda near your stove. Well, it's time for us to do
PSA. Yeah, I was going to ask Chief Gurka, just you normally, and in the later fall, have another fundraising activity, or you work with, you were here last time when we talked about a relationship, Rotary or Kiwanis or?
Goodfellows.
Goodfellows,
right.
Yes, that's correct.
And that's
correct.
The usual, is that the next, fundraising activity going on is later in the fall, October, November?
Yeah, I think we've got that coming up. You know, the firefighters are always involved in muscular dystrophy. On occasion, they've done their fill the boot campaigns. Other times, they gather up funds and send in donations. For MDA. So that's also something on the horizon.
And and my apologies on the air that I wasn't here when the show began, but of course Ned is our host after all. But you mentioned about the fire department being a young boy's dream, and certainly that was your case, Chief Gurka, but how many female fire persons do we have today? Or does everybody like to be called a fireman?
Of the 53, how many are women, I guess?
Well, we have one. So we have one female firefighter, and she's also the person that helps us with our grants. So she'll do a lot of grant writing for us. And she's married to an individual who's on the hazmat team. So she's also,
a firefighter on the hazmat team?
Yes, from another community. Oh. So
just because we do have a fire safety, I think, or fire protection certificate program here at the college, a very well regarded one. It is a career that women can consider. That there's. That there may be some selective issues, and I don't know about the housing and the fire building where you have to more or less be quickly on call, but I'm sure that those things are, I mean, the privacy issues, that those things can be handled and have been for years and years. So we just want to say it's a career area that certainly women can consider too.
Yeah, but do you do in the firehouse? Get a special room for her?
Thanks, Ned.
Well, you know, when we built our headquarters
station. You must have made it with a woman in mind.
Well, the new headquarters does have a female locker room, and we also have our bunk room set up where we have dividers, and you have a measure of privacy there, so that we do have a way to handle that situation.
And you have two buildings and four shifts? Like two 12-hour shifts? How does that work? Or is it two 3-day shifts?
Well, there's three different shifts, A, B, and C unit, and they work a 24-hour day. And they average out about 48 hours a week that they're working. Some weeks they end up working more, and other weeks they have a little more time off.
Does this include staying there, sleeping there, the 48 hours?
Sure.
Yeah, but there's always a day in off in between. So if you work... You know, a Monday, you'll be off Tuesday, and then you'll work Wednesday.
Is there something we missed we should ask you that you're dying to express?
Well, you know, from a fire safety aspect, I just wanted to share with everybody that I think a lot of people don't realize what have really injured and killed some of our residents over the years has been the misuse of gasoline. And I just want to reiterate to our listeners.
They keep it in the garage for their lawnmower.
For their cars now, too, maybe.
Well, it's great in your lawnmower. It's great in the fuel tank of your car. But let me give you a quick example. We had a man several years ago who brought gasoline into the basement to clean up some tar residue from some in between some of the tiles that had oozed out. And those vapors are heavier than air. They stay low, and they ignited on his water heater on the pilot light. And there was a ferocious flash fire, and
the pilot light is close to
the ground, mm-hmm. and burned this individual, and it later became a fatal burn. You know, he succumbed to infection, and it was it was a real tragedy. And over the years, we've seen a number of things where folks use gasoline as a solvent, which you never want to do for cleaning parts or never bring gasoline into your home. Period.
And there you go.
It might also apply to other cleaning fluids, too, that have the solvents or petroleum base, because they're flammable.
Yeah, but at least they're based on doing some cleaning, bringing raw gasoline in the house.
Well, that's the worst, probably.
Idea.
Yeah,
That's bad, but you bring up a good point about other flammable solvents and flammable adhesives. We had a case of a gentleman who used tube after tube of flammable adhesives while renovating his home.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the caulking type guns can be used to apply stuff to walls or panels, and some of those are not flammable, but most of them are. Most of them have flammable fumes that come off them.
You have to read that then.
Yeah, yeah.
You mean caulking, any regular caulking?
Well, not I'm talking about adhesives that come out of like the tubes that you use a caulking gun for.
You do that to a tube anyway. You'd put it in a gun like that.
Well, just be careful, folks.
And read the label. Yeah. And in that case, the individual is using a cutting wheel, a grinder, and sparks were created. And then there was an ignition and an explosion and some severe injuries. The particular individual didn't die in that incident, but was in the hospital for many, many weeks.
Well, you have been a wonderful guest, and we want to play some PSAs, and I think Jay has some news items we want to talk about in Dearborn Heights.
But thank you so much, Chief Andy Gurka.
This has been extremely interesting. I hope our listening audience learned something more about those safety issues. Do not bring gasoline into your house.
Absolutely.
Especially the basement.
That's right. We don't want anybody getting injured.
Right. And we haven't done our PSAs and our station identification.
Thanks so much, Chief Gurkha. We'll be right back after these public service announcements here on Dearborn Heights News and Views.
Whether you're curious about cognition, attracted to astronomy, or delighted by dinosaurs, you'll want to join us. Seth Shostak and
Molly Bentley and
WHFR each Tuesday at noon for Are We Alone?
Are We Alone explores the science and technology that define life on this planet.
And perhaps on other worlds. Are We Alone? You'll find it here on WHFR 89.3 every Tuesday at noon. That's Are We Alone?
We're making waves on WHFR 89.3.
If these UFO, these extraterrestrials are so highly evolved, how come it is that they only address people named Bubba who are hunting and fishing?
I'm Fife Symington. In 1997, during my second term as governor of Arizona, I saw something that defied logic and challenged my reality.
I saw one, but I don't know where it just disappeared.
And the saucer flew right over him and put down three little gear and landed out on the dry lake bed.
Governors, U.S. presidents, and former astronauts are among the millions who have witnessed UFOs. Many are now coming forward with their stories. Investigate the evidence the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when WHFR presents We Are Not Alone.
And we're back with more of Dearborn Heights News and Views with your host, Ned Apigian. My name is Jay Koronick, and I'm here in the studio, too. I just wanted to sum up that every Tuesday we have two talk shows in a row. The first is pre-recorded that you heard in that announcement just 55 seconds ago. It is the Science Hour, and we're using a syndicated show for that, not produced here in Dearborn. But in the second hour, the Forum series varies with each Tuesday, but they come back again every month. And next week on Tuesday from 1 to 2 o'clock, it'll be the We Are Not Alone show, talking about UFOs, other unexplained phenomena that the usual media in Detroit doesn't cover. That's why we say we are truly the station making waves. And now we're back with our host, Ned Apigian, and we're going to talk about some local issues. What has been happening in Dearborn Heights out there, Ned? I know that we cannot do an endorsement here, and you can't talk about your situation politically since you're running for office in Dearborn Heights. We're careful not to allow you to sound off in a way that might improve your chances here. But tell us about the runoff. Just there was one of the three people for the Dearborn City Council election to fill a vacancy.
Yes.
And you were one of the candidates in there. And we did talk about this on the Journal last Friday, so I'm not going any further than that. But I was interested.
Tell me how that works.
Well, yeah. How does that work? And I think you said it's happening actually tomorrow at the city clerk's office. How does a recount? First of all, the gentleman who placed last and was only a few votes away from second, and the first and the second position would go on
close, very
in
close.
November, right?
It seems as though, and this is not new, apparently any candidate who reaches the cutoff point, if there are five position and there are six candidates and the sixth one is three or four votes closer to being five, and five is what you need to be on the ballot, that person, or she or he, has the opportunity to request for a recount.
Yes, and
but it costs them.
Apparently, it's $10 per precinct, and that's 42 apparently precinct areas in Dearborn Heights, and so it's going to cost that person
roughly $400.
$420, yeah. And but the city clerk in the Dearborn Press and Guide or the Times Herald story that we covered from last week said that it's all by machine anyway, so they're not actually going to physically count. One ballot, two ballot, three ballots. They're just going to, I guess, retotal the electronic machine readouts from all 43 precincts.
You know more about it than
me. Well, it would be interesting. I'd like to find out from you before my Friday show.
I'll tell you what. I'm invited to go to the recount.
Yeah.
But which I wasn't. I was debating even going, but.
Apparently, and I've had this reservation about the use of electronic machines if all they're doing is re-adding the 42 numbers from the 42 precinct machines.
Yeah, I think okay. I thought there were 39.
Well, however many, then if there was an electronic error, nobody would find out. Nobody would know. I mean, is there a way to find out if there was a malfunctioning machine? I mean, certainly this person who is paying the money for the recount would want to have some way to know that no machine malfunctioned.
Well, in Dearborn Heights, I don't know about where you vote in Dearborn. It's an optical thing. That's actually a piece of paper.
Right.
It's fed into. Which you fill in an oval.
Yes.
So that paper exists. All the machine did was read it.
That's right. So I guess they can resubmit all those individual sheets.
Yes. Not only that, you can hand count them, I guess.
I guess it could be, yeah. Well, I'd be interested to know if you could call me on myself before the Friday Journal show exactly what process they're using tomorrow.
I'd be happy because, first of all,
I'd like to know the results, too, for our listeners.
I think the county controls this, and the county decided when it would happen, and the county decided
well,
on
that's good.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, outside, so the city clerk is going to be there, of course, in charge of providing
the documents,
but you have an outside independent control, too, from Wayne County, you think?
I was surprised to learn that the ballots are in the clerk's possession locked up.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, the county's going to come and somewhere in the city hall spread out these things or resubmitted them into a machine or hand count them. I have no idea. I'll find out.
Yeah, I'd really like to know. And for the sake of all of our listeners, I mean, I personally, as a voter, I would like to have a paper receipt given to me, not just that I voted, but who I voted for, so that if it was ever requested, I could take it back in and they could compare it with their records. I mean, that's the only ultimate way to make sure there wasn't a malfunction, or let's say somebody filled out one of these forms, let's say pretty much at the same time as mine, under the table or something there, although they do have 3-4 people watching, you know, at the table, but that they added a new form that wasn't there, or, you know, that...
Well, there's another interesting
There must
thing.
Be all, you know, a dozen safeguards to this, but I'm just saying as a voter, I'd like to have my own receipt, just like if you purchase something online, you can print out your receipt for the transaction.
You know the problem with all this, everybody does it differently.
Yeah.
Dearborn Heights uses what's called the optical system. Right. I don't know what Dearborn uses.
I think that's the same.
It's the same system where you fill in the...
We fill in with a black pencil or whatever.
Into an oval.
And then it's fed into a machine, and you can. They want you to feed it in yourself and until it goes in. And
I vote absentee, so as a,
well that would
so
be different.
I don't know what they do with
it. Absentee. Now there's a situation, and I think I even recommended it at the last big election to our listeners, is that there is always the paper record there for them that you fill out. They do save those actual absentee ballots. At least in Dearborn, it can't be fed into a machine. They have to hand submit it afterwards.
Well, maybe. We'll find out. I don't know.
Hand enter, I mean. So that absentees, I know at least in Dearborn, the way they do it, there is always the original ballot, and a recount always has to be done totally manually by a person looking at the form. They can't, I guess they could transfer it to a card and then put the card in the machine for a recount, but it's always done manually.
I'll tell you, they called me yesterday telling me that there's a packet for me, some understanding of how it works. And then the county is going to mail me whatever it is. So I don't know, you know, I was really interested.
Okay, well, we'll find out about how that goes and how they do it in Dearborn Heights, and that'll be part of the new WHFR Journal, if not this Friday, then next week. We don't know if it's going to take one day, Ned. Did they say if it's...
They said it would take a couple hours.
Just a couple hours, so we'll have the results rather quickly.
It would interested me because I didn't know what to do until they... I mean, I could end up being a loser. I don't know.
There's two stories that we covered on the journal from the papers last week that had to do with Dearborn Heights. And,
which are?
And one that you have in front of you right there is about a sound pollution issue. Now, this supposedly went in front of a study session of the Dearborn Heights City Council on the 24th. Now, that was a week ago today, and we don't have the papers for this week, and probably you haven't heard either, but that was just a study session of the
council.
Well,
you're not, some of them are private. Public doesn't
right.
go to.
Yeah, so we may not know until it comes up at a city council meeting, but residents near St. Sebastian Church, do you happen to know where that is?
Actually, I went to a funeral there. It's in the South End.
Okay, but you haven't gone by there recently.
No, I don't live there to know what the problem is.
Okay.
Who's objecting?
Well, as the story, well, they've actually started circulating a petition, and there's a Facebook page now about this. Dan and Sherry Perrine moved into their Merrick Street home in Dearborn Heights 16 years ago, and they enjoyed at that time, it says in the story from the Dearborn Press and Guide last week, they enjoyed the peace and quiet the street provided. Quote from Dan Perrine, "We bought our house specifically to send our kids to St. Sebastian Catholic School, and if we open the door, there it is. Apparently it's right across the street." beginning in March 2009, though, the quiet the Perrines had become accustomed to was broken when St. Sebastian Catholic Church, that's located at 2710 Colgate Street, restored its previously non-working outside bell system. He says they used to play the bells at every hour, every quarter hour, and every half hour.
Wow.
They would start at 8 a.m. and went until 10 p.m. Now they stop at 8:30 p.m. and don't go off at the quarter hours anymore. Now that's just a time thing, supposedly, a recognition, maybe just a gong or two. I'm not sure about that. It says the bell cutbacks occurred after the Perrines spoke with church officials. I mean, they're obviously parishioners.
Perrines, isn't it?
Perrines. Perrines, Perrines, one of the... Yeah, it's P-E-R-R-I-N-E-S, and my apologies if I said it wrong, folks. But they talked with church officials, Dearborn Heights City Council, and Dearborn Heights Corporation Council, Gary Miatke.
Yes.
Miatke.
That's how M-I-O-T-K-E. It is Miatke.
Right. And Dan, and it's interesting here, we've got a video that I can play right now during the show of this. But, of course, a video, and you can hear the bells in the background. Uh-huh. But, of course, the sound may not be as loud as it would be to a
What's
human
the
being.
What's the duration of the... Is it a single gong or a single...
Well, we'll hear that, right. And they're using, in the video, a hand sound pressure level meter. You can buy these at Radio Shack.
I see.
I have one that costs $30. I think they're a little more expensive now. I bought mine a long time ago. But you can read. They have a little built-in microphone and a meter that tells you how many decibels, and that's the way the regulation in Dearborn is similar. And it says here in this article is that, you know, if you're producing a level of greater than 55 decibels.
So there's a standard somewhere.
Yes. Then it can be actionable. Now, in this case, according to the story, that there is an exemption that's been made by the city for
St. Sebastian.
Right. even though it's quite clear that this is in a residential area where it should be 55. Now, of course, Ned, I'm talking to you in the WHR studios. We're about 4 feet away here in the studio behind two microphones. And if I had a sound pressure meter, you would discover where you're sitting, I'm speaking at 70 decibels to you.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's not constant. So I thought we would play this little video. It only takes 1 minute, and
sure,
our listeners can hear and also hear from Dan Perrine and apparently a representative from the church, who I didn't think was identified, who is talking about this. So let's just listen to this, folks. This is directly off the internet. You can go to pressandguide.com, and the video was actually produced by Millard Barry, who is the award-winning photographer, but I guess he's a videographer now, too.
Award-winning from whom? Where is he?
Well, from all over the state.
From the state?
I think, he's won numerous awards for his photography and as a teacher of photography and videography. He does beautiful, beautiful work. But whether or not the video is good, here's the audio.
We got to put this in the communications department for them to play with.
Here's the audio track, folks, and I trust it'll take a minute and 20 seconds. It's loading right now.
As close by neighbors hope that Reverend Jeff Day will come to understand that you have to listen. That you have to listen to those who oppose just as much as you listen to those who approve. And if not, we will be counting on City Council to take control of this serious situation and make it fair for all. You can't just blare loudspeakers into homes that close, some within 40 feet, that excessively. This is noise disturbance all day long, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, to the extreme, and it is just not fair. And one more thing, Reverend Jeff Day never even asked the neighbors how they would feel about a loudspeaker system right across the street from their homes. Just woke up one day, there it was.
Just at 64.
It was just at 64. And play on before Mass on Sunday.
Before Mass, understand.
One too many of them, you know. You don't have to do this all week long. It's just not fair to...
Into the late even the hourly times, you know. Used to be a 9
personally, I know what time it is. I don't need to be reminded.
8:30, I think.
I have cell phone.
We're not out in the fields any longer.
It's modern times.
Okay, that was the video that came directly from the Press and Guide website. It was Dan Perrine reading a statement about how he would like collaboration and discussion about this. And they mentioned, Ned, that this is 7 days a week, and they don't feel that, you know, they understand that maybe on Sundays before their church services, which are, I think there's three services they mention in the morning.
8, 9, and 10 or something.
Yeah, something like that. I have to say, I'm one of those people, and I think I'm religious in my own ways, but I like to sleep in on Sunday morning. So if I was across the street, even 8, 9, and 10 bells would be disturbing to me. The there was a woman standing there who's not identified that seems to be speaking for the church, or maybe, I mean, maybe it's Dan's wife there, that we don't live, you know, we live in a tightly packed community in Detroit area, and so I'm sure that, and
I don't
I
think she was talking for the church. She seemed to be making the point against it.
Right, yeah, that we're not out in the middle of a field, and, mm-hmm. and it was technically in violation, although the city attorney, Miatki, has stated that it's a difficult legal situation here.
Why is that?
Well, let me go through this, and let's state it correctly. Father Jeffrey Day, reverend at St. Sebastian's, they call him a reverend? Wouldn't he be the priest
yes.
if it's Catholic? Isn't reverend a term for a Protestant minister?
And anyway, you know something, reverend father you could call people.
Oh, well, of course. Him. Okay, well, it's respectful, and I guess. He says, we really are within all of our rights. It's a First Amendment issue. At this point, I don't really know what else to do to placate what people are complaining. We are... Oh, what
First
to do
Amendment
is you,
rights
you
have
stop...
to do with individuals.
Well, yeah, I mean, your own... parishioners are who are across the street are telling you they don't want this every day of the week, and not every church does do that. So what you can do to placate them, to use that term or your term, Father Day, with all due respect, I'm just saying, is obviously you turn down the volume because it's an electronic system. Okay, or you don't ring the bell so much. You just, I mean, I don't really know what else to do. Well, you turn down the volume, or you don't play them as often. He says, we are within our rights, and we're within the ordinance. Well, according to the meters that were used in the video, you're not within the ordinance. You're about 10 decibels over. And you say, well, what's 10? Every 3 decibels
unless
is...
Unless they got an exception.
Every 3 decibels, first of all, is twice as loud. Okay? And for every 6 decibels... people can hear the difference. So 10 decibels is almost, because it's...
Three times.
No, it's actually an exponential increase. It's by the square. So it's almost 4 times louder than 64 dB than 55 dB. So that is louder. Everybody can hear it's louder, and it's clearly above the 55 dB ordinance. And of course, maybe it's a meter that's not calibrated, and if you're standing even 10 feet further back... it's going to decrease significantly. So the distance of the meter from the building is a question. You can't just stand, and they weren't. They were across the street from the building, mm-hmm. okay, in that video. They weren't right on top of it, where it obviously would even be louder inside the, or nearer the church. So there's a question of how does the city want to use their sound pressure level meters if they're going to come out and investigate this.
My own opinion is, I guess, outside the speakers where, I mean, right at it is where you would do the 55, not some arbitrary
distance. Well, off their property. Away. I think certainly it'd have to be off their property, wherever that is, whether it's the public sidewalk in front
right
of St. Sebastian's.
Right away in front of the church, that's a public.
Yeah, or the first nearest house.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a home to the left and the right of them on the same side of the street. It looks like the Perrines or the Perrines' home is across the street. Yeah. Now, on March 25th, 2010, and we have to conclude in just 2 minutes, so this will be our only story here, I guess, but there was a meeting on March 25th of this year where the parties agreed to reduce the noise levels to 55 decibels. The church was advised to immediately lower the volume to levels permitted by Dearborn Heights. And Day said, I thought we had reached an understanding, I thought we were at peace. But when they measured it later, they weren't quiet enough, okay? And so as of press time last week, Day had not read the signed petition, Father Day, but said the bells do not go off as much as the Perrines say they do. He says it's not accurate. I don't know who we're disturbing at 12 p.m., 3 p.m., and 6 p.m. So he claims it's only three times a day, not every hour. So there's some real differences in points of view here,
well,
and I can understand why the city council wants to have a session.
Every 15 seconds.
Oh, every 15 minutes. It was quarter hour.
Oh, right, every quarter hour. That's four times an hour.
That's right.
That's times how many hours from 8 o'clock till 10 at night?
Now, St. Anselm Parish, which is on West Outer Drive in Dearborn Heights, also has a carillon system playing chimes. And again, I think it's electronic. You know, it's PA systems.
I live behind the church. Okay. I never even hear it.
Okay, Father Maloney there at St. Anselm says that they play from 9 a.m. until 9 p.m. every hour on the hour. He says they also play 5 minutes before each Mass at 8 a.m., 10 a.m., and 12 p.m. on Sundays, but we don't play any hymns. Okay. Okay, Miatki said, currently St. Sebastian's bells are exempt from the allowed decibel level for a residential area. So that's that agreement they worked out back in March didn't involve the city. And at this point, there is an exemption. And he does say, Miatki, the lawyer of Dearborn Heights, says that the hymns are controversial because it's up to the listener to interpret if the hymns are bells or if they're simply recorded songs. Miyake said the St. Sebastian would be zoned in a residential area because the whole neighborhood is zoned residential.
Right.
But
that's
he says it's a legal issue, not a quick issue. Tuesday will, this last, a week ago Tuesday from today, they were going to see about eliminating the exemption, maybe across the whole city. So we'll find out what's going on there. I know, Ned, you'll keep your ears open, right?
you know what's interesting? I don't live that far from St. Anselm's
Church.
You
haven't noticed a problem.
I never even noticed it.
Well, now you will. Now that we mentioned it, you didn't think it was a problem, so maybe we shouldn't have mentioned
no,
it.
No, my own opinion is it is interesting, but...
We've got to say goodbye now. Ned, tell them about the show, and maybe you want to...
Well, we'll be... I'll read the closing, you'll be looking for us on September the 30th. 31st is our Tuesday, I think. Nope.
It's going to be November 30th.
November 30th.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You'll have to wait till November 30th if you want to hear my beautiful voice. Again, on this subject, anyway.
You'll hear about the election results in Dearborn Heights at
that
point.
Hopefully we'll hear about the election results. Jay will tell you.
And have a great
Friday.
Special guest, too.
Yes, yes, hopefully. I want to have the clerk and the treasurer to explain to you what they do.